bottle of Coke over Julian's head. We care for each other. We love each other. We...
Do you need a moment?
No. I can do this. Please, carry on. I need to do this for them.
And what happened once you were back inside?
We went to the sitting room to get warm. Sebastian was desperate to get at a certain bottle of whiskey, something quite special that was locked in a cabinet. He was crawling over the floor to get at it, and he almost knocked the wall in trying to open the cabinet. Peter had to get down on the floor to help him. It was a very special bottle, and we drank some and toasted and talked. I think it may have been too much because Peter felt ill, and then Angela drifted off to bed. Thea went to give everyone glasses of water before going to bed herself. She always does that, future doctor, always taking care of everyone. Yash was ill as well. Sebastian, Julian, and I stayed there to finish the bottle. We were talking, and then I saw the light.
The light?
Something flashed outside. Not lightning, I mean a torch or something. It was on the ground, a beam of light. I thought maybe it was Rosie or Noel.
Where was this, exactly?
Somewhere just outside, close to the house. I think it was coming in the general direction of the drive, from the left, across the front patio, like someone was coming round the side of the house. That's what it looked like. I got up to see if it was them, and I was thinking it was strange because you could only have a torch if you were a seeker, and neither of them had been found. Sebastian and Julian didn't see it, but Sebastian was facing away from the window, and Julian was doing something, not looking that way. But I was facing the window. I saw that flash, clear as anything.
When was this?
I honestly don't know. I was a bit beyond telling the time. It was a torchlight in the darkness, though. The sun comes up quite early this time of year, around 4 or 4:30. So before that... But I don't think much before. I thought that must be Rosie or Noel, so I went to the door, the main door out the front, and I called to them and told them to come in. The game was over. I kept shouting for them. I shouted. I called to them.
Are you all right? Do you need a moment?
May I have a cup of tea? I'll be all right. Please, may I have a cup of tea?
Excerpt from the witness statement of Sebastian Holt Carey. 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
This is your family house, correct?
Sebastian Holt Carey.
That's correct. And your family is away? In Greece. We have a house there. They go several times a year. And you've come up from Cambridge with your friends to celebrate graduation? That's correct. Do you mind if I have a cigarette? That's fine. So these are your friends. Housemates, is that right?
Yes.
Your family knew you would be here.
They are aware.
And what staff is there at this house?
There's no live-in staff. There are cleaners who come in a few times a week. There are gardeners, at least 4 usually. The head gardener is Chester Jones. He lives in Ramscote.
There were no staff on the grounds last night.
No, it was just us.
Do you think it would be known locally that your family was away?
I would imagine so. You know what it's like in a village. Everyone knows everyone else's business.
Is the gate at the end of the drive always locked?
Always.
Who has the code to get in?
I don't know. Everyone who works here or makes deliveries, I'd imagine.
I don't think the code would be much of a secret around the village. How does one access the gate if the power is out?
It can be unlocked with a key.
And who has a key?
I do. My family. Chester.
You told the others the outbuildings were locked, is that correct?
Yes.
And that includes the woodshed?
Yes. We recently put a lock on that because of the burglaries in the area. People break in to steal tack. We've lost a number of saddles over the years.
How did you know everything was locked? Did you check?
I didn't have to. My family is in Greece. They lock everything before they go.
During this game, you were the seeker?
Yes.
What did that entail?
Standing down at the folly, mostly. Shouting.
When the team found people, they'd bring them to me. I'd give the new seekers yellow rain slickers and a torch. It's a silly game.
So you were standing in the folly most of the night?
Yes, I had some shelter from the rain.
And the game ended when the power went out?
Yes, the lightning got far too close. It felt a bit like tempting fate to run around outside when trees might fall on you, or lightning catch you in the open. We made one final push, found Julian clinging to the top of the pergola, and suspended play.
Who found him?
Angela.
Who decided you should all go back inside?
It was a collective decision.
What time was this?
I believe it was around 2:30.
What happened when you came inside?
Well, we went back into the sitting room to get warm, wrapped ourselves in some throw blankets, stoked the fire. There was a very good bottle of whiskey in the cabinet that I thought we needed to drink to mark the occasion. I got it out.
Using your keys?
Yes, but it was awfully dark. I fumbled with them for a bit, got the bottle out, we drank it. People began to peel off to retire.
Do you recall who went first?
Angela or Peter, maybe. Theo went at some point. She usually does a Florence Nightingale run after a long night, delivers water to everyone's bedside. I know I was in the sitting room with Suze, Yash, and Julian. Yash became ill and left. Julian and Suze were having a silly spat about something, and Julian decided to go off. Suze and I finished the bottle and passed out where we were.
Did you see or hear anything out of the ordinary?
Well, it would be hard to hear anything. The rain was hammering at the windows and whistling in the chimney. It was that kind of night. At some point, Suze said she saw a torchlight go past the window.
Did you see it?
No, but I was not incredibly focused.
What time was this?
I don't know. Julian was there, I think. I just remember her saying she saw a light, and she called for Rosie and Noel, but no one answered. Other than that, nothing. The next thing I remember is that it was morning, and Theo was standing over me with a mug of tea, saying we should go and look for Rosie and Noel.
Are you currently under the influence of alcohol?
I am, yes. I prefer not to be sober today.
It might be best to have some tea or coffee instead. Perhaps something to eat.
No, thank you.
All right. You can return to the others. Thank you.
12. Rain. The promised rain of England. That endless dribble and steel clouds. That was the morning outside the window. The morning after an anxiety attack was always odd in its ordinariness. Hours before, the universe had been collapsing like a flat-packed box. And now day had come and everything had slid back into place. Aside from feeling tired, she was okay. Anxiety was just a weird creep sometimes. Of course, she had also lost a night in London with David, winked it right out of existence in a haze of terror and medication. That was what he was saying not to worry about, of course. Last night had not gone precisely to plan, but it had not been a failure either. Tonight would go better. Today's schedule was another dense program of tours. She was late waking up, so she took a quick cold shower and pulled on her hoodie and jeans. Some days she would make more of an effort than that, but today was not that day. There was a raging blister on the back of her left heel. She shoved a folded tissue down the back of her shoe. It wasn't a great solution, but it would have to do.
You okay?
Nate asked her as she stepped out. He was leaning in his doorway, dressed in an oversized and pilled brown sweater and slouchy jeans. The gray English light suited him. It was light for indoor people, for ghosts, for royalty and urchins, for writers. Fine, she said.
Are you sick?
Janelle asked as she and Vi came down the hall. They had put in the usual effort. Vi was wearing a pair of purple overalls with a silver-gray turtleneck underneath. Janelle wore a fuzzy, open-weave red sweater that she had knitted herself, along with a matching hat.
Just an anxiety attack, Stevie said. It's fine.
Vi reached over and gave her arm a reassuring squeeze. Then it was out into the cold, busy streets of the London morning.
We should take the bus, Janelle said. I've worked out the map. We're going to Westminster, and it's not far. Most of the stuff we're going to see today is close together.
They joined a group of morning commuters at the bus stop and clambered inside the bus, taking the steps up to the second level. They scored seats at the front and brushed away some candy wrappers and soda bottles to take in the view. From here, they got a strange floating perspective of London and the street, and there was the illusion that cars and bikes were being sucked under the bus as it went along, like a land whale gliding down the street, consuming all in its path. They were starting at Westminster Abbey, which was a place that Stevie had often heard mentioned, but had never taken the time to think about at all. Abbey made it sound like monks or nuns would be living there, but it turned out to be a cathedral on a massive scale. Another day, another tour guide enthused about dates and walls and people named Edward and Henry. Westminster Abbey turned out to be the work of Henry III again, who was so obsessed with a guy named Edward the Confessor that he had to go and build a cathedral about it. When he was done, he moved Edward's body into it, putting it on a massive plinth that had been picked bare of ornament by people coming to worship at it.
This is what happens when fanboys get out of hand, Nate said, looking at the monument and then up at the expanse of ceiling.
The abbey was designed to make you feel small. Look at this ceiling. Look at it barreling up toward heaven. Listen to the spooky echo of the organ, the ethereal sound of human voices in harmony spinning around the room. You got lost in it. The building wanted you to know your place. No matter what you did, no matter how hard you tried, someone was doing more. It was also, the guide informed them, the place where England kept a lot of its famous dead. Over 3,000 of them were buried there, and many more memorialized in marble and stone and glass. There were many kings and queens there, buried under mounts of marble with statues of their bodies in repose. You could do a selfie with Elizabeth I, and people were. From there, it was across the street to the Houses of Parliament and the Palace of Westminster, the seat of the government of the United Kingdom. It wasn't where the beheadings happened, but it was often why. Another break, another sandwich. Obligatory pictures with the giant lions by Nelson's Column. A relentless trip through the National Gallery in clammy clothes. The tissue stuffed into her shoe kept sliding out of place and sticking out the back, so she kept hopping and shoving it back in. Eventually, she took it out and allowed the pain to come through. Art, 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 art. At a certain point, nothing made sense. It was bulk information, stimulus overload, things to check off a list.
I've got 21 schools still on my list, Janelle said out of nowhere.
What? Vi had been considering a dark painting of an arrangement of fruit with what appeared to be genuine interest. It was hard to tell. Vi was great at putting on a neutral face of interest. They wanted to go into some kind of international work to fix the world, and that was going to require going to a lot of meetings about boring things and talking to terrible people. They had mastered the blank stare. It was a gift.
I was just thinking, 21 schools, 7 are in Boston. Well, not just Boston, in Massachusetts.
I need to get that list down.
Okay.
Vi didn't seem that interested in the topic of colleges at the moment. So Janelle turned to Nate.
That's too many, right? She said. I can't apply to 21 schools. That's crazy.
It seems fine, Nate said.
Nate had not been looking at the paintings of fruit with any interest. Nate would tolerate most things for about an hour if he knew there was the promise of a snack and the chance to be left alone in the near future.
When the answers come back, that's going to be more to decide. I want to make the cuts now. I mean, I'm not saying I'd get into all 21.
You will, Vi said.
But if I did, then I have to figure that out. Plus, that's about $2,000 in application fees, and all the stuff to write and get. I feel like, I don't know, 7 is a good number? Or 10? How many are you applying to?
I don't know yet, he said.
Probably not 21, though, right?
No,
he said. Janelle had not included Stevie in this conversation. perhaps because Stevie had riveted herself to a picture of a cluster of men dressed in black, standing around a table in their big hats. Why ask Stevie about college? You might as well ask one of the billions of Trafalgar Square pigeons their thoughts on inflation. Stevie was delighted when her phone buzzed and she saw a message from David.
Where are you guys now?
National Gallery, she wrote.
Are you almost done? Because we're outside.
We, Stevie said. Sure enough, they were on the steps. With David, shivering in an oversized pink coat, was Izzy.
I need your help, she said. My aunt is missing.
Missing? Janelle said.
She's gone,
Izzy said, nodding.
She hasn't answered any of my texts or calls since the other night. She doesn't do that. She always answers me. So I went up this afternoon to see what was going on, and I went in and... she's gone. All the things from the other night are still out. Food, dishes. She would never leave those. Something is wrong. And I looked on her tablet, which gets her texts. Look at this.
She pulled a tablet out of her bag and showed Stevie part of a long text chain. The messages were marked from the night they had been there to visit. 9:23 p.m. Angela.
I'd like to propose a get-together. Maybe this weekend. I think we should have a talk. Seb is Merryweather free.
9:23 p.m. Angela.
I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important.
9:27 p.m. Sebastian.
The house is free, and I think I could make the weekend work. What's going on?
9:28 p.m. Theo.
I could possibly get coverage. Is something wrong? Are you all right?
9:29 p.m. Suze.
Currently backstage. I have a performance Saturday evening. But we're dark Sunday. What's going on?
9:31 p.m. Peter.
I'm scheduled to take the kids to Peppa Pig World this weekend, but I'm happy to bow out of that.
9:31 p.m. Peter.
But same question.
9:32 p.m. Theo.
Ange?
9:33 p.m. Suze.
Ange, are you all right?
9:41 p.m. Yash.
You make it sound serious, Ange. What's happening?
9:45 p.m. Angela.
It's about what happened.
9:45 p.m. Angela.
We need to talk.
9:46 p.m. Angela.
And I don't think it can wait.
9:46 p.m. Angela.
She had the button.
9:47 p.m. Theo. Question mark? 9:48 p.m. Suze.
What Theo said?
9:48 p.m. Yash.
Button?
9:49 p.m. Peter.
What?
9:50 p.m. Suze.
I have to go back on stage. Please, someone explain to me what is happening.
9:51 p.m. Sebastian.
Can you ring me?
9:55 p.m. Theo.
Ange.
9:57 p.m. Theo.
Ange, can you pick up?
9:58 p.m. Peter.
I just rang as well and it went to voicemail.
10:16 p.m. Suze.
I'm back. Can someone tell me what's going on?
10:18 p.m. Yash.
Genuinely confused about what's happening right now.
10:21 p.m. Julian.
I'm at a dinner. Is something wrong? What's going on? My phone keeps pinging.
10:22 p.m. Theo.
And please ring me whenever you get off the phone.
10:24 p.m. Suze.
Which one of you is talking to her?
10:25 p.m. Yash.
Not me. Does anyone know what's happening?
10:26 p.m. Peter.
Not me.
10:27 p.m. Julian.
Is there something wrong with Ange? I need to rejoin the dinner.
10:29 p.m. Theo.
Ange, please ring.
It goes on.
Izzy said. Just lots of texts from everyone asking where she is, including me.
What's this about a button? Stevie asked, scrolling down.
I have no idea, Izzy said.
That's not a phrase, an English thing?
No.
Izzy was right. This didn't seem good.
So I thought, David said, that we could help. Maybe by going to her house and having a look to see if anything seemed off. That's kind of your thing.
He laid on a particularly charming smile. He was right. Going into other people's spaces was Stevie's thing. She had done it at Ellingham several times when one of their classmates was killed and another went missing. She had even done it to David himself, something he didn't let her forget. Her proclivity for investigating spaces was both a serious thing and a joke between them.
He wasn't supposed to just talk about it like that.
Still, probably a good idea to have a look through Angela's house.
Can we talk for a second?
Stevie asked Izzy. We just have to figure out what we're doing.
Of course, of course.
Stevie stepped off to the side with Nate, Janelle, and Vi.
Do you think this is a thing?
Vi asked. I don't know, Stevie said. Angela had a serious trauma, and then she said weird things on painkillers. Every story I've ever heard about a crime, every person that's been through something that traumatic, they have theories. They try to work it out.
She was high. I don't know.
But now she's gone, Vi said.
People freak out, Stevie replied.
And need help when they do, Janelle said.
You should go and do it. We can put together the report for today.
It was time to go through a house.
13.
Outside the snug little house in Islington, Doorknob was waiting for them, meowing loudly and throwing himself against their ankles and rubbing for all he was worth. Izzy scooped him up.
You poor thing. Look at him. Look, he's hungry. He's scared.
Doorknob seemed to be neither of these. He thrust his head into Izzy's chin and purred, then rammed his face down the front of her sweater. Izzy produced the keys and admitted them into the house. As they stepped into the dark hallway, Stevie slipped on something and grabbed the wall. She looked down and saw that she had almost been taken down by a pile of mail, including some glossily finished flyers for Domino's Pizza.
See?
Izzy said, extracting a local council statement from under Stevie's shoe.
Today's mail, and look, her coat and bag are normally here.
Izzy indicated some empty pegs on the entryway wall. There was a stillness, an odd quality houses get when they are left to their own devices, even for a short while. Everything appeared just as they had left it the other night. The living room was in order, with a few mug rings and leftover crumbs on the coffee table from where their tea and cookies had been. In the kitchen, the remnants of the takeaway were still in evidence. There was the bag, the containers. There could be no question that this was the same meal. The receipt was stapled to the bag with Izzy's name on the order. The dirty plates were in the sink, still stained with curry and with rice sticking to them.
The tea mugs were sitting by the sink, and the pack of hobnobs was on the counter, half open.
She left these plates, Izzy said. That's not her. She wouldn't go away and leave plates like this. She wouldn't leave food out.
The rest of the kitchen seemed to indicate this was true. The small table was clear, save for an ornamental striped bowl, filled with apples and oranges. Stevie opened the cabinets and looked inside at the jumble of mugs. Many patterns and types, but all where they were supposed to be. It didn't seem like the kind of place where leftover curry would be allowed to sit out for days, the plates allowed to crust over and collect flies. This was a house out of its own rhythm.
Doorknob yowled by his bowl, so Izzy got a pouch of food out of the cabinet and filled it. He began to eat at once, in noisy chomps. Maybe Izzy had been right about Doorknob. He ate with urgency. This was a cat not used to missing meals.
Stevie went back through the living room, took a long look at the elaborate cat tree in the corner, and cat toys that were scattered around the room. The litter box in the downstairs bathroom was overflowing and ripe. She walked the downstairs again, testing the windows. All were closed and locked. There was a cat flap out of the kitchen window leading onto the roof of the level below,
but no human was going to get through something that was only a few inches high. "What's under this apartment?" Stevie asked. "Another apartment?"
"No," Izzy said. "Someone rents it for storage. They run a catering business and leave extra tables and chairs and things down there."
"Did you check upstairs?" Stevie asked Izzy.
"Of course. I checked the whole house. I'll show you."
Angela's home office was just off the landing. It was a small space with file cabinets, stacks of books, pin boards filled with references and business cards and pictures. Her laptop was open on the desk. Stevie tapped it awake. It asked for a password.
"I know what it is," Izzy said, sitting down. "I had to use her laptop once when I couldn't find my phone. It's Cleves, as in Anne of."
"Anne of?"
"Anne of Cleves. Henry VIII's fourth wife, the lucky one. But I went through this already. I opened every folder and file. There's nothing on here but script notes and parts of the book she's working on. I looked through all her email. There's nothing of note. Her schedule says she has a meeting at the BBC in 2 days.
"What about her search history?" Stevie asked. They checked. Angela had a mundane online life. She updated her social media. She searched furniture sites for rugs and cat supplies. She looked up simple recipes and ordered takeout. She paid some bills. Most of the time, she was using libraries and online archives to do tutor research. It wasn't promising, but Stevie copied it anyway and sent it to herself. Stevie took a moment to open the file cabinet drawers. They contained bills and household records, utilities, insurance, a passport. "She didn't leave the country," Stevie said, holding it up. They then examined Angela's bedroom, which was slightly less tidy than the rest of the house, but within the bounds of reason. She had some clothes on a chair, but the bed was made and decorated with a small silver throw pillow.
"If we're going to look," Stevie said, "we need to look. That means the drawers, everything."
The three of them set about opening all the drawers, the cupboards, the closets. They found nothing out of the ordinary. Stevie examined the bathroom. Every single sign pointed to the fact that Angela had left the house sometime after their visit and had not returned.
"You see," Izzy said, "she left after we were here. I'm worried we said something. I said something. Something that upset her. This isn't her. She wouldn't just go and not tell me."
Izzy and David looked at Stevie expectantly. Everyone was waiting for her to do something, to pull a rabbit out of her hat. But all Stevie could see was a house with a missing owner. She went into the bathroom in an attempt to look busy while her wheels were turning. She felt the towels. They were dry. Opened the medicine cabinet. Just normal stuff, nothing marked poison. Checked for a toothbrush, an extremely fancy electric one that looked like it connected to an app. It was hard to look like a brilliant detective.
"There's still the box room," Izzy said.
"The box room?" Izzy motioned them back out into the hall. She reached up and pulled down a hatch that Stevie had not noticed. This revealed a folding set of steps. Izzy pulled them down and Stevie climbed up. The box room was just barely a room. It was more of a glorified crawl space with shelving taking up three of the walls and a sloping roof that made it impossible to stand up. These were full of standing magazine boxes full of papers and binders. There were slim document boxes with labels like Star Chamber, Primary Document Copies, Thomas Cromwell, 1517 through 18, Naval History, Lecture Notes. A whole room of documents, as you might expect from someone who researched for a living. Stevie sat down, and Izzy and David came up and crushed into the little space with her. There were boxes of materials from her time at Cambridge, course catalogs, syllabi, printouts of research papers. In with these was a box of scripts from the Nine, rustic early computer printouts with gray lettering. The three of them opened every box, but it became evident that these were Angela's old academic records and archived research materials. Stevie's phone began to ring. Quinn. Of course, the evening call.
"Hi," Stevie said, trying to look casual.
"Where are you?"
"At the historian's house," Stevie said. "The one from the other night?"
Always tell the truth when you can. Lie only when necessary. This was true.
"You look like you're in her closet."
"In her attic,"
Or her archive. She's letting me go through her research. She slapped her hand around until she found something printed out on an ancient printer titled Burning Faith, England During the Dissolution of the Monasteries.
Are you developing an interest in the Tudors?
Dr. Quinn asked.
Yeah, Stevie said. The Tower got me really interested in Henry VIII. It's sort of about crime, right? He was a murderer, really. What else do you call a man who kills two of his wives?
This was a direct swipe from Angela, but Stevie didn't think she would mind.
An interesting point, Dr. Quinn said. Are you doing this on your own?
No, Stevie said. David was there, but so was Izzy. Stevie swept the camera around so Dr. Quinn could see. We're working together, Stevie said. That's Izzy. Angela is her aunt. She studies with David. A long pause.
I look forward to hearing your thoughts on this topic over the next few days, Dr. Quinn finally said. And maybe we'll incorporate some Tudor history into your program.
Definitely, Stevie said with a nod. Her lips were dry, and her smile was flat.
Do you think she actually believed that?
David asked when the call ended. I think she's not sure. Probably not. But I'm not doing anything wrong by sitting around with some history papers, so she can't say anything. Dr. Quinn was gone, and the moment passed. Stevie was just a weirdo sitting in a pile of someone else's old homework.
Does this tell you anything?
Izzy had a hopeful look, like she had expected Stevie to have found her aunt inside one of the boxes. It didn't. None of it did. What the hell else was there? Just piles of history, dirty dishes, a hungry cat. What did detectives do now? The partner, of course. Who else is in her life? Stevie asked. Was she seeing anyone? She has an ex-husband. His name is Marvin. He's fine. He's a journalist. He lives in Hong Kong. They haven't seen each other in years. Not one of those angry things. They just broke up because he was always traveling the world for the BBC, and she was here.
Anyone else?
Izzy shook her head. What about your family? Angela is your mom's sister?
Oh.
Izzy compressed her lips together a bit.
Yes, but my mom died when I was a baby. I've gotten closer to Angela since I moved to London. My dad wouldn't know where she was. I'm the only one who would know. I don't know anyone she works with. It's just me and her friends.
Stevie pinched her nose and ran her hand down her face. She smelled of dust and old paper, and she was out of ideas. I think we can put this stuff back, she said. They attempted to restore the box room to the way they'd found it and descended the ladder, then went back downstairs. Stevie wandered in circles for a moment, looking around the living room. What could she learn? What did she see? The bricked-up fireplace with the beautiful Art Deco tiles, the books, the rich patterns of the wallpaper, the smell of the old food and cat litter. She had forgotten the most important thing. The trash, Stevie said.
I suppose we should take it out.
No, Stevie said. We need the trash. They returned to the kitchen and turned on all the lights. There was a silver step can in the corner, as well as two recycling bins. There was a pair of rubber washing gloves resting on the sink. Stevie grabbed these, then looked in the cabinet under the sink. Trash bags. She pulled out the roll and ripped a few off. Here, she said to Izzy and David. Spread these out. The kitchen floor was soon covered in slippery plastic trash bags. She picked up the silver step can. The trash had been festering for several days, so it had developed a pungent hum, a sour stink that made Stevie scrunch her nose involuntarily. She pulled out the bag and dumped the contents onto the floor. She did the same with the recycling, making a separate mound a few feet away.
Well, David said, if she comes home right now, this will be nice for her.
Stevie put on the kitchen gloves, then got on her knees and started picking through it. Trash was archaeology. Trash always told the truth. The recycling, for a start. It was all clean. Everything had been sorted correctly. Angela took lids off and broke down boxes. There were two empty wine bottles, 7 empty sparkling water bottles, at least a dozen containers from ready-made meals from the grocery store, pre-made soup, lasagnas, and salads in plastic containers. A single person's diet. Someone busy. The trash must have been emptied recently because there was very little in the bag. Some plastic shrink wrap from a package. A chewed-up shoelace. 2 receipts from Boots, which was the major drugstore chain. Angela had had a cold recently. She'd purchased a decongestant and throat drops, as well as body wash and a toothbrush. Nothing strange. Stevie lifted the lid of the compost bin and dumped the food scraps and piles of used tea bags onto an empty corner of plastic. "She drinks a lot of tea," Stevie said, nudging around the disgusting pile. "She doesn't finish most of her meals." Doorknob had been interested in these proceedings and chose this moment to make a move. He saw a piece of old chicken, snagged it, and ran off. "No," Izzy said. "Doorknob, no, you'll be sick." She hurried off after the cat. David squatted down and looked at Stevie from across the pile of garbage.
"Hey,"
David said.
"We go on the best dates, huh?"
He said it mirthlessly. Stevie nodded.
"What do you think?"
he said in a low voice, craning his head to make sure Izzy was out of earshot. But there was no worry. Izzy could clearly be heard running around the living room calling for Doorknob.
"It looks like she's gone," Stevie said, pointing out the obvious. "No sign of forced entry, no sign of a struggle. It seems like we ate dinner with her and then she left. You asked me to look and I looked."
She indicated the pile of trash she was lording over as proof.
"I know,"
he said. What was that tone in his voice? It was dispirited, but what did it mean? She had failed. The great Stevie, the one who busted into places and turned up things. She had nothing. She had not performed the trick. All she'd done was spill a lot of garbage. She wanted to say something, explain herself. But before she could, Izzy called them.
"You should come in here," she said.
They found Izzy on her hands and knees on the floor. She had pushed back an armchair that was tucked into the corner where the stairway met the wall. The bottom half of her body was sticking out. She crawled backward and looked up at them.
"Doorknob dragged the chicken bone back here. There's a little opening. Look."
She pushed back the chair. The paneling under the stairs had been papered in a lush tropical print, and at the corner, the panel had been pushed back a few inches, just enough for an enterprising cat to squeeze through. Izzy felt the panel and found that it was hinged. It was the opening to a very small cabinet.
"I didn't know this was here," she said. "So this is where the Hoover is, and this is where Doorknob has been keeping things."
Stevie leaned in to look. Sure enough, this was the spot Doorknob collected his little treasures. His toy mouse, part of what looked like a real mouse, a used tea bag, 2 buttons, a crumpled tissue, a dirty cotton swab, a grape stem. Izzy pulled out the canister vacuum cleaner and stuck her head into the opening. She dragged out a heavy, blocky briefcase.
"Look at this," she said, pushing it farther into the center of the room so they could see it.
"It's a fire safe," Stevie said. "Document storage."
This model had no key lock. It had a keypad instead.
"No chance you know the code, is there?" Stevie asked.
Izzy shook her head.
"I had no idea she had that. What's it for?"
"Important documents, usually," Stevie said. "Records, wills, insurance, passports.
Important stuff. It's a safe, basically, that keeps your papers safe in fires and floods."
"I think she keeps all that kind of thing in her office. So what's in this?"
"Unless we have the code, we won't know."
"People tend to use bad passwords and codes," David said. "The password really is password a disappointing number of times. What's her birthday?"
"The 9th of February."
"So 0209, Stevie said, putting in the digits.
"No, 0902, other way round."
"Right. England. Many things were flipped here." She tried both versions. Neither worked.
"Birth year?"
Izzy counted back.
1974.
That didn't work either. "Okay," Stevie said, standing up and making a circuit of the room, peering at the bookshelves.
She's a historian. Loads of dates in history.
It's pretty much all dates,
David pointed out. But she does Henry VIII a lot, right? Her specialty is the Tudor period, Izzy replied. Which is... Izzy consulted her phone for this information. 1485 until 1603.
Those two dates were tried and did not work. Nor did the year Henry VIII became king, the beheading of Anne Boleyn, Elizabeth I becoming queen. Eventually, they tried every number between 1485 and 1603.
What about 1066? Izzy said. That's the big year in English history, 1066 and all that.
It was not 1066. This group, Stevie said. They're called the Nine. Is it something to do with that?
The only thing they could think of that would work was 9999, which did nothing. Nor did 1995, the year of their graduation and the event at Merriweather. For good measure, Stevie also tried the default 1234, just to make sure Angela hadn't kept the factory setting. She had not. The box refused to divulge its secrets.
Could we force it open? David said.
Stevie shrugged to indicate this was worth a try. They looked around the flat for something to use to pry it open, finding a large flathead screwdriver in the utility closet. They all attempted it, but the box resisted.
It's pretty solid, Stevie said. It's designed to take a beating. What now? Izzy said.
Her frustration at not being able to open the box, at the sight of the house and the growing evidence that something was wrong, all of it was making her tearful.
I think we take this with us, Stevie said. If she turns up, we just bring it back to her. But we keep trying to get it open. Is that okay?
Izzy nodded emphatically.
But there has to be more we can do, she said. I'm going to talk to the police tomorrow. I've walked around the area. I've even talked to some neighbors to see if they saw or heard anything, but no one did. What do I do now?
She looked at Stevie with such an open, pleading expression. She needed help. She needed Stevie. Stevie had failed in the house, but Izzy had not given up on her. David was looking at her as well. Think, Stevie. What do you do?
She thinks one of her friends committed a murder, Stevie said. She texts those friends to say she wants to meet. She says something about a button, something about going to Merriweather. This is about the Nine. Do you know any of them?
A little, Izzy said. I've met Theo before. She came over several times after the surgery to check in. She's a doctor. And the others have all been around. I don't know them well, but I know them.
If Angela was talking to them that night, then we need to talk to them. They were the last people she was in touch with, and it sounds like she wants to see them. Are they around here?
Izzy considered. Theo, yes. Suze, yes. And Peter and Yash, I think they are too. Julian, I think he's an MP in New York or somewhere up north. Sebastian lives at Merriweather, which is up near Cheltenham. So four of them are in London.
Okay. Stevie scratched at her forehead and thought. We need to talk to them, but we need to do it now, soon. Can you text them? Ask if we can meet with them as soon as possible.
I can do that, Izzy said, pulling out the tablet.
She typed furiously for a moment.
Theo's working 12 hours tomorrow, she said. Suze has a show in the evening. She can do the afternoon. And Yash and Peter, they say they'll go to Suze's house. We can meet them there at 2?
She looked up hopefully. 2 was the middle of their carefully scheduled day. She would have to make it work.
2, Stevie said. Where do we go?
Excerpt from the witness statement of Theodora Bailey. 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
Can you walk us through the events of this morning, starting from the time you woke up?
Theodora Bailey.
Yes, I woke around 8:30. I'd gone to sleep around 3, so I was still quite tired. But I can't lie in. I went downstairs. I cleaned up the kitchen a bit. Then I started walking around the house to see if everyone was all right. Not sick, I mean.
Where was everyone?
Angela, Yash, and Peter were in their rooms. Sebastian and Suze were asleep in the sitting room. Julian was in the library.
The aftermath of a party?
Exactly. And I kept looking, knocking on doors, checking all throughout the house for Rosie and Noel. But they were nowhere. And as everyone woke up and got hungry, I decided it was time someone went looking for them. They'd been out all night. I assumed they were passed out somewhere. I wanted to make sure they were... Oh, God. May I have some water, please?
Are you all right to continue?
I'm all right now. I can continue. I went with Sebastian. It's his house, and he looked like he could use some fresh air. We started by going down the front garden, up toward the folly. Then we wound our way around the former gardens on the orangery side. Around the back, checked in the pavilion at the tennis court, then came around through the trees where the woodshed is.
I'm sorry, but I must ask you to describe the scene as you came upon it.
I understand. I know. The woodshed is just beyond the drive, in the trees. There was a wheelbarrow. On the ground, in front of the woodshed. Tipped over in the mud, there was a bucket. And the door to the woodshed was open, about halfway open, so we could see a bit inside. And we could see the latch had been forced, the door was ripped open. It was clear someone had broken in. It was very wet inside, puddles of water on the floor. The wood piles were knocked about into these odd stacks on the floor, these mounds, and at first it just seemed like someone had broken in and made a mess of the place. But then Sebastian had this odd look on his face, and then I saw what he saw. There was a boot under one of the mounds, and part of a leg, and I thought, that's odd, someone is hiding under a pile of wood. But the leg was so still, I couldn't make sense of it. It didn't make sense. I went over and started moving some of the logs away and...
Take your time.
Yes, I'm all right. Yes, what I saw was not consistent with life. I did not have to check her vital signs. Sebastian had backed up, and in doing so he found Noel. Noel's condition was the same as Rosie's. Sebastian and I left the woodshed. Sebastian was starting to go into shock, so I moved him away from the area and got him back to the house. We called you.
You said the others went out shopping while you were looking for your friends.
Yes.
It was just the two of you who came upon the scene.
Yes.
Did you move anything aside from the logs?
We got out as quickly as possible. We didn't want to touch... Once we saw, I've tried to be clinical. I've tried to report to the best of my capability. I find I'm quite cold and my head. I'm sorry.
You've done very well. You can go back to your friends. Have a cup of tea.
Excerpt from the witness statement of Julian Reynolds, 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
Can you tell me where you went as the game began?
Julian Reynolds.
I went out the mudroom door, at the back of the house. Did you see anyone else go out that way? Susanna. Where did you go? I made a loop of the back gardens, which are extensive. There's a maze, but that seemed too obvious a spot to hide. And there are so many little topiary spaces back there, rooms... But there's nowhere to hide in them. I left to find a better place. I circled the house at least twice, running all around, looking. Did you ever go past the woodshed?
Yes.
Did you try to get inside?
No, the outbuildings were locked. There was no point in that.
And you knew that because Sebastian had said so, or because you saw it locked?
We were told it was locked.
It certainly appeared to be locked. Eventually, I had an idea that I would climb up the pergola, hide on top. That's what I did. I thought I'd get rumbled, but I was there for ages. People walked right under me. At first, I was pleased, but I was soaked to the bone. I was there for hours. Literally hours.
Did you see Rosie or Noel at any point during the game?
I saw Noel.
Where did you see him?
In the back garden.
Where precisely?
In one of the topiary areas.
That place is a maze. It's hard to say, but it was in there somewhere.
And he was alone?
Yes.
When was this?
Early on. Very early on.
Could you be more precise than that?
I only know it was early. I'd say within the first 15 minutes of the game. It was during my first pass of the back garden.
Did you speak to him?
No. I don't think he saw me. He was moving quickly. He went out one of the exits, and I didn't see him again after that.
And what about Rosie?
I didn't see her.
You and Rosie, you two were recently in a romantic relationship.
Yes.
How long had that been going on?
A year, or a little less than a year.
A year, so quite a long time then.
Yes, I suppose, yes.
But it had recently ended?
Yes.
Why was that?
Does it matter?
We need to ask these sort of questions. Can you please tell me about the end of the relationship? Was this recent?
Within the last few weeks.
And what was the cause?
I did something that upset her.
What was that?
This really matters? Please answer the question. About a week ago, we were all at the pub. We were having a laugh. I'd finished my exams and I had maybe one too many, and I think I knew Rosie and I wouldn't be continuing the way we were. And I kissed another girl. Just some girl I met there that night. It wasn't serious, but Rosie found out, of course. Everyone saw. But that's what our... these things, we've... It happens. I'm not... I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Rose. I'm sorry.
Unintelligible.
We'll end this for now.
14. The next day, they followed the schedule. They began at the Natural History Museum, which was an ornate palace of rocks and bones. From there, they went to the Victoria and Albert Museum, the Design Museum, which contained, among other things, a massive collection of clothing and fashion-related items from the ages. Janelle was beside herself looking at Victorian ribbon corsets, ancient Egyptian shoes, Balenciaga ball gowns, and Frida Kahlo's used cosmetics. From there, they were supposed to go to the Science Museum. They took this opportunity to call Dr. Quinn.
Calling a little early, Janelle said. We're going to the Science Museum after this, and there's an interactive program about climate change that starts at 2.
It helped that this was the truth. The plan was that Stevie would leave them at this point and take the tube to meet Izzy. David couldn't come, he had a class. Going into the tube by herself turned out to be an exhilarating and nerve-wracking experience. Something about being on her own in this place for the first time, without anyone to notice if she was going west instead of east or getting on the wrong train entirely. London was hers in this moment. She stuck to the plan. Stevie watched the stops carefully, fearful of missing hers. Knightsbridge, Hyde Park Corner, Green Park, Piccadilly Circus. She stepped off the train into a kind of free-for-all of people and coats and bags, a massive crush of humanity that drifted back to the upper world on long escalators, with more of the flashing, synchronized advertisements. It was madness. There were way too many doors leading out, and she got turned around and caught up in the crowd, and had to make her way back around to meet with Izzy, who was waiting by the statue of Eros. Izzy looked sleepless. Her winged eyeliner was not quite on point, and her cheeks were flushed pink with cold and effort. I went up to her flat again first thing this morning, she said, to see if she was back and to feed Doorknob. Still nothing. What do we say when we get there?
Your aunt thinks that one of her friends might be a murderer, Stevie said. She talks when she's under the influence of painkillers, but that's the only time.
She's probably kept her suspicions to herself. We don't tell them about what your aunt said about the lock. We just get them to talk.
We ask if anyone has heard from your aunt, and then see if we can get them to talk to me about the case. Let them say anything that comes into their minds. Just let them talk. In London, there were no street signs on poles at corners. The elegant street plaques were on the corners of buildings themselves, often at second-story height, so Stevie was always looking up. She looked up at buildings stately and twee, buildings that looked like old soot, and others that were pastel mint and butter yellow, or finished in fine decorative work from a different age. The streets got narrower, barely the width of a car. They passed down the proud old Compton Street, which was clearly the center of the gay district. They wound around corners and through alleys. This was deep in an old part of London, something lively and varied, probably a bit questionable at times. Suze lived behind a stark black door on a street of cafes and shops that were so perfectly adorable and expensive-looking that Stevie felt poorer just being near them. Suze's particular door was between a vegetarian cafe, painted sky blue, and a purple-gray bow shop. Izzy hit the button for flat two, and the door popped open with a gentle buzz. They ascended a set of creaky internal steps carpeted in red, several of which slanted toward the left, like the house may have been knocked over at some point, and hastily propped back up again. Flat two was at the top of the stairs and was fronted by a modern door that didn't match the rest of the interior. It opened, revealing a tall, red-headed woman with enormous almond-shaped eyes. She was dressed all in black, slim black trousers, a form-fitting black turtleneck sweater. Stevie didn't really know how cashmere was different from other materials, but somehow she knew that everything Suze was wearing was made of it.
Isabel!
She wrapped her arms around Izzy. It was a wide, all-encompassing embrace.
This is Stevie, Izzy said. She's a friend. I brought her along because... No need to explain. When I was at university, I went everywhere with my friends as well. You know that. Come in, come in. Peter and Yash are on their way. They were just finishing up a rehearsal.
They were admitted into a small but perfectly outfitted apartment. The main space had a white shag rug and two cobalt blue sofas. There was a lot of black and silver and mirrors in curious places. By the door there was a rattan organizer that held shoes, magazines, books, purses, a hairbrush, a makeup case. The kinds of things a working actress might drop on the way in late at night, or need on her way out the door again. Every inch of wall space was in use, encrusted in pictures and framed posters from shows, dozens of them. Pictures in frames on the shelves, pictures magnetized to the fridge and the hood of the stove, pictures rotating through multiple digital frames. Suze had selfied long before the world knew what a selfie was. There was Suze with some vaguely familiar faces. Stevie had to look twice before she recognized an actress from one of her favorite English detective shows. There was Suze in black and white, dressed as a ringmaster. Right by the galley kitchen was a long photograph of an entire class from Cambridge, all in white skirts, draped in black academic gowns, arranged in a formal photograph taken outside. In calligraphy at the top, around a double crest of two shields, were the words Cambridge University, Magdalen College, Matriculation 1995. Suze noticed Stevie pause in front of it.
"Several of us in that one," she said. "Angela, Peter, Noel, and I all went to Magdalen."
She pronounced it Magdalen.
"Cup of char?" she asked.
"Oh, yes, please," Izzy said. At Stevie's puzzled look, she clarified.
"Tea, sorry, would you like some?"
Stevie nodded.
"I've been racking my brain," Suze said as she filled the kettle. "I've been texting. I've been talking to the others. It makes no sense. It makes no sense, Izzy. She's not like this. Not Ange. I don't understand it."
"That's why Stevie and the others are here. Stevie is..."
"Sebastian told me, and I read about you when he explained. Can you help us?"
It was always a bit weird when strangers put their faith in her. Just this morning, Stevie had almost eaten the stopper they put in her coffee. She wanted to say something wonderful and brave and inspiring, but what came out was,
I can try to do...
Suze fidgeted around the kitchen, letting Stevie run out that sentence. She peered out the window to a roof beyond it, where three cats sat in a triangular formation, staring at each other.
They do this, Suze said absently. For hours, stare at each other like this. I'm afraid one of these days they're going to tear each other apart.
Which one is yours? Stevie asked.
Mine? Oh, none of them. I'm allergic to cats. Hives all over.
Everyone considered the impending battle as the kettle began to rumble to a boil. Suze was on it as soon as it clicked, dumping hot water into mugs. It seemed to focus her. She fussed around, grabbing tea bags and mugs and tiny spoons and a tray. She moved with the lilting motion of someone who ran through life on the tips of her toes. They sat in the living room. Suze draped herself elegantly in the corner of one of the sofas, tucking her bare feet under her, and stared out over the steam of her tea. No sooner had she done so than the buzzer rang.
That'll be Yash and Peter, she said, bouncing up.
Yash Varma was a tall man, with dark brown skin and a thick, well-sculpted beard that rounded his jaw. He had sparkling brown eyes. There was genuine merriment there. He seemed like the kind of person who laughed easily and often. He came in, peeling off a green peacoat and revealing a scrappy Nirvana t-shirt and jeans.
Sorry we're late, he said. Terrible read-through for the show. We're going to be absolutely bricking it by the time we film tomorrow, unless we suddenly get much funnier. I don't hold out a lot of hope for that, his companion said.
Peter Elmore had a tousle of reddish-blonde hair, which appeared even redder against the rust-colored pullover he wore. Everything about Peter had an air of intentional slouch, a comic casualness. Yash was the high energy, and Peter was the slower, lower note. Izzy commenced with the introductions, explaining Stevie's presence.
We want to find out what she's been doing recently, Izzy said. We're just trying to get information in general.
Of course, Suze said. Anything.
When did you last see my aunt? Izzy asked.
Last week, Peter replied. She was at a party I had at my house. We were all there.
Pete and I got an award for our show, so we were having a celebration, Yash said.
It wasn't a tough competition,
Peter added.
We were only up against one other show, which wasn't very good. I wrote that other show, Yash shot back. That's why he's saying that. He's being smug about it. I gave you the idea for that show.
You wish.
You too, Suze said. Shut it.
And how was she? Izzy asked.
Did she do or say anything out of the ordinary?
The three looked at each other.
No,
Suze said.
She was in good spirits. She's working on that new program about Henry VIII. She was telling us about that. She's always happiest when she's working on a project. She was in a wonderful mood. We all had a bit to drink.
Maybe too much,
Yash said.
It was a proper old-school party. I think she ended up sleeping on your sofa, didn't she, Pete? I gave her the bedroom,
Peter said.
I slept on the sofa.
She brought me a lip balm, Suze said. I'd given her one a week or so before when we were out and her lips were chapped. It was a nice one. Penhaligon's orange blossom. Nothing beyond the pale, but they cost maybe 11 quid. It's my favorite. When she got to the party, she had a replacement. The same exact one. That's Ange. If she borrows something, she always replaces it. Always pays you back. She never wants anyone to worry or be put out. She wouldn't go off and leave everyone worrying.
Would you mind talking a bit about what happened in 1995? Izzy said. Stevie really is an absolute genius. She has a way of working things out. I know it's not an easy subject, but my aunt was talking about it with us that night, and maybe it was on her mind. Maybe if we knew more about it, we could figure out if it played a role in where she went.
The soft wind of Izzy's conversation blew across the room, lulling them into a state of compliance. The excessive praise and discussion of her methods made Stevie start to sweat under her vinyl coat. She stripped it off, revealing the hoodie underneath, the traces of salad dressing still down the front.
All right, Suze said. If you think it would help.
We all met as freshers at Cambridge. We came from different colleges. We met at auditions and drinks after auditions, things like that.
The three of them engaged in a little back and forth for a moment about who met who at which pub or party or school event, and who introduced who to whom and where, and then, sensing that they had strayed from the discussion at hand, Suze waved her hand in a graceful gesture that suggested the words, or something like that, it doesn't matter.
We sort of just, well, came together right away. We were best friends, and we decided to make our own theatrical group, write and perform our own comedy sketches. That's a common thing students do.
We all did a bit of everything, Peter went on. But we had some loose roles within the group. Yash and I wrote together, like we do now. That's where we started. We were the main writers. Angela wrote a lot as well, Yash said, and Rosie did some writing.
Theo directed, Suze said, and the others nodded. She also did a lot of producing, getting us spaces to perform.
Suze, Julian, Sebastian, and Noel were our primary performers,
Peter went on.
Noel was our special character, Suze said. He was good at playing authority figures. He had a hilarious way of being on stage. He just made you laugh without doing much of anything at all.
Peter and Yash nodded at this.
We weren't bad.